from Pacifico Radio. This is Democracy Now!
As I mentioned the other day, in the U.S. today, there are more prison inmates now than there are farmers in this country. But this attrition has been, you know, even much more severe in the African American community, who've been leaving the land at 3.5 times the rate of other farmers. Around 1920, there were 1 million black farmers in this country. Today, there's about 18,000 left, and fewer than 175 of them are under the age of 60.
Today, a speech by J.L. Chestnut, the first black lawyer of Selma, Alabama. Then part two of our conversation with South African Supreme Court Justice Albie Sachs. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak was quoted today as saying he's still committed to peace with the Palestinians, although recent violence has changed the term of any future peace deal. He said he did not think Palestinian President Yasser Arafat was ready for peace, adding that Palestinian police appear to be doing little to stop the violence. This, as a Palestinian youth was once again shot dead by Israeli soldiers yesterday in clashes in the northern West Bank town of Jenin, the second killed in the day. The youth was shot in the heart with a live bullet by Israeli soldiers posted near the southern entrance of the town. His death raises to 138 the number of people killed in almost 4 weeks of violence, overwhelmingly Palestinians dead. All but eight of the fatalities have been Arab. Earlier yesterday, another Palestinian youth who was 16 years old was fatally shot in the stomach by Israeli troops near Eretz, the crossing point in the Gaza Strip. This news from Santa Cruz, California. The city council has voted unanimously to pass the nation's highest minimum wage, $11 an hour, or $12 without benefits. Initially, the living wage ordinance would only cover full-time workers for the city or for-profit companies with city contracts. Santa Cruz officials hope to eventually extend the minimum wage to temporary workers employed by the city and its social service agencies funded by the city. The ordinance approved last night had no formal opposition as it was being developed over the last few months. The Gore campaign seized on the news that a grand jury is investigating whether a subsidiary of a company that Dick Cheney led until the summer billed the federal government too much. The investigation centers on whether Brown & Root, a subsidiary of the Halliburton Company, the oil and energy services company Cheney led, overbilled the government for its work decommissioning Fort Ord in California. Investigations stem from a suit filed in 1997 by a former Brown & Root employee who asserted that the company had overbilled the government by $6 million and used shoddy materials. Government prosecutors originally declined to join in the case, but a federal grand jury subpoenaed witnesses to begin testifying next month. This, according to the Los Angeles Times. And this on the front page of the New York Times today. Concern that Ralph Nader has become a major threat to Vice President Al Gore's ability to win the presidency. The Democratic Party and its allies in the labor, environmental, and women's movements are mounting aggressive campaigns in swing states across the country to dissuade liberal voters from supporting Nader, the Green Party candidate. In the Pacific Northwest, the League of Conservation Voters is preparing to run radio advertisements asserting that voting for Nader would be tantamount to voting for Governor George W. Bush. In Ohio, the state Democratic Party has begun flooding college campuses with leaflets urging students not to waste their ballots on the Green Party. In Wisconsin, the Service Employees International Union has dispatched hundreds of organizers to implore its 12,000 state members to vote Democratic, not Green. And the Democratic National Committee has organized an array of prominent liberals, including Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Gloria Steinem, and Robert Redford, to stump for Gore in Nader strongholds like Eugene, Oregon, Madison, Wisconsin, and Seattle. Not wanting to offend Nader or his supporters, those surrogates have been paying homage to his long record of fighting for a cleaner environment, consumer protection, and labor rights. But the New York Times goes on to say they warn that a strong Nader showing can only help Bush with potentially dire consequences for the very causes liberals hold most dear. This news from Chicago. Alarmingly high numbers of uninsured adults aren't getting needed medical care, and the problem is especially severe among those not in good health, this according to Harvard researchers. The findings contradict the notion that the nation's uninsured can get needed services through various safety net measures. This according to the researchers in today's Journal of the American Medical Association. Nearly 10% of the nearly quarter of a million surveyed respondents had been without health insurance in the long term, which means for at least 1 year. About 70% of the long-term uninsured who were in poor health said they had not gotten needed care, such as checkups or treatment for specific problems. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And, you know, Amy, I wanted to remark on an article that appeared in yesterday's Financial Times, which for those people who are fascinated with investing in Internet companies these days. But there was a report by the Kroll Associates, the investigative agency, which said that Internet executives are four times more likely to have what Kroll called unsavory backgrounds than executives from other industries. Mm-hmm. And an investigation that Kroll conducted over the last 6 months, it found that about 39% of the people of the executives that they looked into had problems, which included things like previous violations of Securities and Exchange Commission rules, insurance fraud, undisclosed bankruptcies, frauds committed overseas, and even links to organized crime. That's an astounding percent for even Wall Street these days. So watch out for that next.com that you're urged to invest in, if any of you out there are doing that.
Are we seeing some red baiting here, Juan, the red baiting of dot communists?
No, just questioning backgrounds, that's all, backgrounds, historical records.
And in election news, a lot of things happening around the country, but most significantly this piece. I think it's interesting. The only time you see these pieces on Nader in the front page is of the newspapers is not when he's taking on the issue of corporate crime or when he's had the largest campaign rally in this election season, but it's when he is cast in a negative light. It has to do with where he stands with Al Gore. And, you know, when the competition is only going to be mentioning his name, and that's when they are concerned about him. So you hear the story of all of these people now being trotted out to deal with Ralph Nader around the country.
Well, Amy, it's not surprising. We're only a couple of weeks away from the election. And this is, of course, the most important election in the world. For the most powerful post in the world. And it's crunch time now. And the contradictions always sharpen in the society at all levels and in institutions and political parties around this time. And so it's not surprising that the people who are ignoring Ralph Nader are now seriously concerned. And, of course, it's a huge debate in the progressive movement in the country, a debate that has legitimate points on both sides. But many people are torn. Now, as I said in a recent column in these times, Gore or Bush for many of the progressives, and it's a difficult issue. And now you have many people with long historical progressive traditions now out, like Jesse Jackson and Gloria Steinem and other environmentalists now, Friends of the Earth, are being like enlisted to stump for Gore in hopes of winning those folks who could be decisive in terms of who is sitting in the White House come January.
And in the coming days, we're going to have some of those debates on Democracy Now! And we encourage you to call in and leave us your comments. I'm going to give out our comment line, and we'd like to know what you have to say about who you'll be voting for and what your concerns are. Also, if there are interesting races in your area, initiative, ballot referenda, let us know. Our number is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. You can also email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Well, Juan, we're going to turn now to a speech that was given this weekend. It was given at the Bioneers Conference that took place in Marin County, California. I went out there, was invited to talk about environmental investigative journalism. But there were three major plenaries in the morning where all sorts of people spoke. The Bioneers were founded about 11 years ago. By Kenny Aucibel of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Bioneers are biological pioneers, and the conference features an eclectic group of speakers from around the country, scientists, doctors, authors, academics, artists, who subscribe to a declaration of interdependence that says humans and nature are inextricably linked. The Bioneers Conference encourages its participants with models and networks to act as primary forces in the transformation toward a restorative future. Well, today we're going to hear the speech of one of the winners of a Bioneers Award, J.L. Chestnut. He was the first African-American lawyer of Selma, Alabama. And, well, I'll let Kenny Aucibel do the introduction, which is more than an introduction. It puts J.L. Chestnut in the context of the struggle for land in the Black South.
We're really, really privileged to have J.L. Chestnut with us today. You know, the context here is that, of course, family and traditional farmers have been leaving the land basically because they can't make a living farming. As I mentioned the other day, in the U.S. today, there are more prison inmates now than there are farmers in this country. But this attrition has been, you know, even much more severe in the African American community, who've been leaving the land at 3.5 times the rate of other farmers. Around 1920, there were 1 million black farmers in this country. Today, there's about 18,000 left, and fewer than 175 of them are under the age of 60. So we face the extinction of an entire and incredibly rich and vital culture, and a rural culture mostly in the southeastern United States. And that was much of what brought Mr. Chestnut to our attention, because he and his colleagues at the Federation and some other groups have really been directly responsible for the possibility that this might happen. And it is a possibility at this point. It's up to all of us here in this room to get involved with this. He's been one of the lead attorneys in what's become the largest class action civil rights victory in American history on behalf of black farmers. And at the root is institutional racism on the part of the United States Department of Agriculture, which, by the way, is the second largest United States body after the Pentagon. That's how huge it is, with offices and outlets in every county, every town. I mean, it's extraordinarily pervasive and has basically become an agent of agribusiness in the broadest sense. When the Federation was founded around 1967, its purpose was primarily to help African-American rural families to create cooperatives and credit unions as economic tools to enable people to remain on their land and to remain on their land farming. And its focus has really been on community-based economics and solutions. In 1990, it collaborated with others to file this first lawsuit, which has led to this extraordinary victory against the federal government and has resulted in a partial victory and an ongoing struggle. And it's worth remembering in the 1980s that Ronald Reagan actually essentially dismantled the Civil Rights Division, so that all the complaints from black farmers of institutional racism, which we'll hear a lot more about, of being denied loans or being denied access to loans, not only were not heard, they were put into boxes and crates which gathered dust in federal buildings in Washington. Farmers, I had the privilege a couple years ago of attending one of the Federation's conferences in Alabama, and when you get behind the numbers and actually hear the humanity and the stories of what happened to people, it's absolutely heartbreaking. Even when people managed to get their loans, or in theory get their loans, they were told that they would be arriving. One fellow stood up and told a story that the loan, he got a letter telling him he'd get the loan, and he was all excited, and it was spring planting, and the letter never arrived, and never, the loan, the check rather, never arrived. And finally it came 6 months later at harvest time, and by that time, you know, he'd already lost his farm. That was it. The land was foreclosed. Very similar story from another woman that I heard who got up and said that she actually was told that her check had arrived, and you know, she was waiting and waiting for it to be there. And finally, a month later, she went down to the local USDA office, where she was told by the official that because she hadn't shown up a month ago, they'd given the check to another farmer, of course, a white farmer down the road, and her land was also foreclosed as a direct consequence of this. There are other stories of farmers going into the office and finding a noose hanging on the wall behind the desk of the bureaucrat. In one case, a farmer was motioned by the official behind the desk, who opened his drawer to reveal a handgun. And that was that. And that was the end of that conversation, as you can imagine. So this is what's been going on. These are not isolated instances, and that's the whole point. It's been a systematic strategy of discrimination and what amounts to land theft and economic genocide. And as Ralph Page has said, many of our ancestors lost their lives to own land, to earn a living from the land, to raise their families in the richness of southern rural culture that is distinctly our own. We have a right to this land. Now, most of you have probably not heard of J.L. Chestnut before, unless you're from Alabama or knowledgeable about civil rights law, in which case you'd know that he's a living legend. He's the first and only black attorney in his hometown of Selma when he got back from law school in 1958. And he was to become one of the most important figures in the voting rights and larger civil rights struggles in the South. He's a cosmopolitan intellect and a jazz musician in his youth, and he was sorely tempted actually by the bright lights of Harlem and New Orleans, and spent time with some of the great black thinkers and leaders of the era, from Thurgood Marshall to James Baldwin, Adam Clayton Powell, and Dr. Martin Luther King. But at great personal risk, he stuck it out where he was born and felt he could accomplish the most. He began in some of the earliest voter registration organizing efforts, driving the back roads to avoid the Klan and the police, sneaking in and out of towns to challenge stunned and hostile white judges and sheriffs and juries in court cases. He went on to play a very prominent role in the events surrounding Black Sunday in March 1965 that finally led to the Voting Rights Act, a major turning point in the struggle. After participating in many subsequent landmark civil rights and other cases, he's become a giant in the legal profession and a formidable force in Alabama politics. He's said to have tried more capital cases than any other lawyer in Alabama, and his law firm is now the biggest black firm in the state. He has never shied away from taking on seemingly unbeatable, awesomely powerful opponents, from long-running battles with the big landowners in the Alabama Farm Bureau to the Reagan administration's heavy-handed attempts to roll back voting rights, to his recent participation in this extraordinary victory as one of the lead attorneys in the largest, as I said, civil rights class action suit ever won in this country. What's especially interesting as well is that Mr. Chestnut is now going to bring the same lawsuit on behalf of Native American farmers. So please join me in welcoming from the beautiful Black Belt counties of Alabama, the truly great J.L. Chestnut.
Thank you, you're so kind. I called my dear wife last night in Alabama and told her that these wonderful people at this wonderful conference gave me an award. They really think highly of me. And she said, don't tell them that there are many people in Alabama who hope you will remain in California. And I said, they're pretty sensitive and intelligent group, I think they would have already deduced that. Racism has a stranglehold on the throat of this democracy. This democracy has many problems, but racism has a stranglehold on the throat of this democracy. And that has been the case since 1619, when the first slave ship docked at the shores of what is now the Commonwealth of Virginia. And it is such an awful thing that America cannot even face it. There is great denial in this land. When one speaks of racism, one speaks of how far we have come without saying that we have to go just as far, and that this second journey is even more difficult than the first trip. If one mentions that we have a long way to go, it comes almost as an afterthought, without exposition, without explanation. We just don't want to face the ugly truth, because racism is an ugly reality. I mentioned last night what it was like when I went back to my hometown, Selma, Alabama, in 1958 to become the first black lawyer there. I didn't tell you last night that 2 months ago, as Selma was in the process, it is now 65% black, electing the first black mayor ever. I didn't tell you that in the process of that campaign and that election 2 months ago, a Lincoln town car parked in front of my office in the dead of night was firebombed to ashes.
You're listening to J.L. Chestnut, the first African-American attorney in Selma, Alabama. He was speaking this weekend at the 11th Annual Bioneers Conference. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman, and we're going to return to the speeches we're hearing from the 11th Annual Bioneers Conference that was held in Marin, California over this past weekend. And We were listening to J.L. Chestnut, a civil rights attorney, the first black attorney in Selma, Alabama, and also the author of Black in Selma, The Uncommon Life of J.L. Chestnut, Politics and Power in a Small American City.
35 years ago, this was 2 months ago. I didn't tell you last night that over the last 40 years, my life has been threatened more times than a Hollywood cowboy. They have threatened to blow up my home, my mother's home, and even my church. And why? Because racism has a stranglehold on the throat of this democracy. I was sitting in my office, and farmer after farmer would come in to tell me about he was nearly losing his land, his small farm. Oftentimes it had been in his family since the end of the Civil War. And that he was losing this land primarily because of the government. And I've been fighting the government so long that I can hardly remember when it was a time that I did not have at least 5 lawsuits pending against the various entities of the federal government, which is like an octopus. And we began to take a look at the situation of these poor farmers. And I expected to find an ugly story. My life is about dealing with ugly stories. That's why I went back home. But I didn't expect to find what was there in relationship to these poor little black farmers and perpetrated on them by their government. They were indirectly being run off the land by people who were supposed to protect them. And then I learned that the United States Department of Agriculture was huge even by government standards. That here was a monstrosity that half the time didn't know whether it was going or coming. And that it had an active presence in every county in the United States. And that it expended billions and billions of dollars to farmers. And that it was granting that money, lending that money in every one of these counties and in the possessions of the United States through what it called local committees. And these local committees were always the richest, most well-connected white farmers in the county. And they decided who got what when, and black farmers didn't. A black farm, in some places, believe it or not, black farmers could only go on Wednesday. And they were being told, we don't have any money, we're out of money. Or if there was a black farmer who was persistent enough, they finally sent him the money, but made sure they would send it after the farming season, too late to plant. And what you did last year affects whether you get money this year. So black farmers were drying up and disappearing. And that is why we filed this lawsuit. And the Justice Department came forward in the courtroom in Washington and announced that it was representing USDA. Now, if that is not a mess, I don't know what is. One huge bureaucracy representing another huge bureaucracy, and all running from the truth. And the court said, well, Mr. Chestnut, are you suing on behalf of all of the black farmers in the United States? And I said, Your Honor, you have it right. And he said, well, how much money are you really talking about? And this is a liberal judge appointed by Bill Clinton. So you can imagine what the situation, well, never mind. And I said, Your Honor, we're talking about $2 billion. And the government laughed. And the court was astonished. Had I been representing white farmers, $2 billion would have been sensible and reasonable. But you don't talk about billions of dollars and black folk in Washington. There's a disconnect there, a historic disconnect. And I said, Joanna, I don't see why everybody is so upset. In Washington, you pay $2 billion for one B-1 bomber. And the Justice Department notified the President of the United States that he didn't have anything to worry about. The lawsuit would be dismissed. The lawsuit was not dismissed. Then they went back and they told the president, well, you don't have to worry about it. The court will never certify a class that includes every black farmer in the country for the last 20 years. That won't happen. It did happen. And then we had two problems. The first problem we had was that farmers, black or white, brown, whatever your color, don't keep records. They're not notary publics or lawyers, they're farmers. And you can't win a civil rights lawsuit without documentation. So we had a huge problem. We had a second problem because of the statute of limitations, which said that if you bring in a civil rights action against USDA, you must do it within 2 years of the act you complain about, or else you are barred from life. You're barred for life from bringing such an action. And none of these farmers, well, 95% of these farmers would go out under that. So we had to go back to the 1960s. We had to go back to what Terry just got through telling you about. We decided to bring all of the black farmers we could to Washington. And they came. They came in pickup trucks 20 years old. They came in 25-year-old beat-up automobiles. They had these little brown paper sacks with cold chicken, and they slept 5 and 6 in one room in a Motel 6, but they came. One fella brought his mule, the ugliest mule I have ever seen in my life. And the mule was large as an elephant. And the mule's name, believe it or not, was Trouble. And we decided to shut the nation's capital down. And Vernon Jordan, my classmate of Monica Lewinsky fame, and very, very close to the president, told the president, said, you need to do something, not merely because Al Gore is about to have a miscarriage, said, but you need to do something because I know J.L. And the president of the United States said he had 30 minutes he would meet with the farmers. And he met with them 3 hours. And he said, in order to solve the statute of limitations problem, I will have to get my friend, the speaker. I said, your friend? He was talking about Newt Gingrich. And he said, the speaker and I are great buddies. And he called the speaker. And from that conversation, I think they were. And we were told to go up the next day and meet with the speaker. And we went up, and the speaker was beside him, said, come in, come in, come in. And he said, you know, we paid the Japanese, and what we've done to you is wrong. We should pay you. I was astonished. And Mr. Gingrich had 2 paragraphs drafted, and they were inserted into the huge omnibus federal budget, just he had way down there, which waived the statute of limitations. And again, my dear wife said, I said, wonder, why did Mr. Gingrich do that? And my wife said she suspects that on every block in Mr. Gingrich's congressional district, a new post office building is going up. I think the lady is cynical. I think he did it because he saw wrong. I think he was sincere. Because the black farmer's story is one that will bring tears to your eyes. But we got the statute of limitations problem resolved. We still had the problem of not having documentation. So we sat down with the government, and to make a long story short, we at last reached a consent settlement. The government had been trying to settle this case from day one, and I was the only lawyer, the only black lawyer there, and I was the only one insisting that it not be settled. I didn't want it pushed under the rug. I wanted this tried in open court so that you, the American people, could hear and see what the government had done to these poor black folks. But at a time, it seemed not in the black farmer's interest to just try that case. The government would be appealing it up to Clarence Thomas, and everybody going forever. So we reached a settlement whereby a farmer who had no documentation, no papers whatsoever, if he signed a declaration and had one non-family member to sign a declaration that he applied for a loan and had been discriminated against, he was entitled to a $50,000 payment immediately. The government would pay another $12,500 as taxes on the $50,000 under his Social Security number and pay it to IRS. In addition to that, he would be entitled to certain injunctive relief to go to the head of the line for the next year, and then there would be a monitor put in place 6 years after this lawsuit shuts down, to make sure that he is not discriminated against. Any debt he owed to the government would be immediately forgiven. And we The average black farmer owes the government between $75,000 and $200,000. So the government immediately forgave all of these debts, but that's income to the black farmer. So the government had to write another check to IRS under the farmer's Social Security number and pay the tax on the debt forgiveness. As I speak to you, 8,000 farmers have been paid $400 million. Another 8,000 will be paid in the next 6 months. The government has paid in excess of $100 million in taxes on the $400 million. For those few farmers who had documentation, they didn't have to go into Track A and accept the $50,000. They could have a mini trial in Washington, and whatever they could prove they lost, they would be entitled to it, which means that some farmers went in on food stamps and came out millionaires. It is the largest class action in the history of this country. And now we have filed the same kind of action on behalf of Native Americans. And the case has been assigned to a judge who is 89 years old, half African American, half Native American. Once we complete the Native American litigation and the government has asked, let's sit down and settle it, but I'm not going to go for any settlement that's going to last over 6 or 8 months. We're going to have to put some money on the table and get it over with this time. I have learned from the black farmer lawsuit. But after we get through with the Native American lawsuit, we are going to file a suit against the government asking for reparations. And for an apology. For federal complicity in 350 years of slavery.
That was J.L. Chestnut speaking this past weekend in Marin, California at the 11th Annual Bioneers Conference. Chestnut is an African-American attorney from Selma and a leading civil rights leader there. And the Bioneers Conference was a gathering of 2,000 eco-visionaries who were gathered there to share theories and practical environmental solutions for restoring the earth. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman. Yesterday, we were joined by one of South Africa's most famous jurists, Albie Sachs. 34 years ago, Sachs was a young activist lawyer and a freedom fighter for the ANC. He was targeted by South Africa's former apartheid regime as an enemy of the state worthy of assassination. Imprisoned twice without trial by South African security forces, his car was bombed by agents of the government. The explosion took his right arm and he lost sight in one eye. In 1994, Sachs was appointed by President Nelson Mandela to South Africa's first constitutional court. With the court, he helped to draft the new constitution of South Africa. Today, he is one of the most influential judges in that country. He spoke with Amy Goodman yesterday about crimes against humanity, reconciliation, and the rebuilding of his nation.
Namibia was the rehearsal for us. It was the real thing for Namibia, but a country on our borders establishing that black and white could live together on the basis of equality in one country. United States clearly is the font of constitutionalism and many basic ideas of separation of powers, a Supreme Court with the power to invalidate laws. The whole idea of having a Bill of Rights was taken from the U.S., but most of the actual details don't correspond to the U.S. Our Bill of Rights is much more expansive. It has social and economic rights. It's not simply a restraint on the state, on government, preventing it from doing things. It also requires government to promote basic rights of people. It's very strong on gender equality. It outlaws discrimination, amongst other things, on grounds of disability, sexual orientation. So it's very, very sweeping. But also our institutional arrangements are rather different. We have, as I mentioned, cooperative governance rather than competitive relations between the center and the devolved powers. We have a multilingual policy that's expressly written into the Constitution. We don't have the strict separation of church and state that you have here. We have a great freedom of religion to believe and not to believe, but a concept of religious bodies being part of the nation, having an active role to play in dealing with public life and public affairs, provided they don't enforce their will on anybody, equality between the religions, and the right of non-believers not to be prejudiced in any way. So there are a number of particulars like that where we're different. Our president is not directly elected, but is chosen by parliament.
Why?
So we wanted to avoid a very, very powerful single figure as head of state. If you think of our background, the old colonial governors were really autocrats, total autocrats. Then you had traditional leadership, which had very strong democratic aspects, which had been undermined in the apartheid era, where the chiefs were built up as alternatives to the Mandelas. And then you had the struggle that we were in with a centralized resistance movement, very much top-down, as it had to be, sending people in for armed combat and so on. Now you put together these three traditions with the all-powerful leader at the top, elected once every 5 years, and we could have had a very undemocratic setup. We wanted Parliament, the elected assembly, to be the main repository of power, and then Parliament would choose the president for a fixed term. And Nelson Mandela had absolutely no problem with that arrangement, as Thabo Mbeki has no problem. It just seems right in South Africa.
Who set the bomb that blew up your arm and destroyed your eye?
I know the name of one of the persons. It's Henry van der Westhuizen. And I know that because he came to see me. He telephoned and he mentioned that he was going to go to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to ask for amnesty for his part in the bomb. And it turned out that his role was logistics, photographing my car, arranging for where the bomb was to be put. And he said that he, in fact, dropped out because they postponed the operation before it actually happened. He applied last week for amnesty. And I sent in a statement saying that if the commission is satisfied that he's given the information that he has to give. I have had no objection to his getting amnesty.
Did you meet him?
Yes, I met him. He came to my chambers. It was a very unusual encounter, let me put it that way, because I stared at him, he stared at me. We hadn't quarreled, we hadn't fought, we didn't hate each other, we didn't even know each other. And yet he tried to exterminate me, and I was the person he'd tried to blow up, whom he hadn't even seen. And so it was the first time we were establishing a person-to-person sort of a contact. What was curious was that he seemed very aggrieved that now I'm a judge, honored member of society, chambers with beautiful pictures around, in a stable situation, representing the new constitution, defending the new constitution. And he is cast aside out of the army, and he almost wanted sympathy from me. And what was unusual or strange about it was that he was angry with the generals and the politicians and the others who had commanded him, used him. And it was like saying to me, but isn't life unfair? And he wanted me to tell him how unfair life was. And I said to him, Henry, that normally when I say goodbye to someone, I shake their hand. I can't shake your hand. But go to the Truth Commission, tell them everything you know, and maybe we'll meet one day. I forgot about that completely. And then some months later, I was at a party, and I heard a voice saying, Albie. And I looked around, Albie. And there was a familiar face. I couldn't quite play. Henry, I said. And we moved away from the music, and I said, what happened? And he said that he'd written everything he knew, and he'd been questioned by Bobby and Sue and Farouk. Now, these were three people who'd been in exile with me. He's using first-name terms, like we're all mates together. And I said, Henry, I've only got your face to tell me that you're telling the truth, but I believe you, and I shook his hand. He went away absolutely beaming, and I almost fainted. But I'm pleased I did that. It seemed right. That's the kind of compact we have in South Africa, that people contribute towards giving what they've got. What he's got is knowledge of the criminality of the past, and he contributes that, and now he becomes a member of our society on an equal basis with everybody.
Who's the person who actually set the bomb, and where did they put it in your car?
I don't know, and I don't know.
Did he tell the Truth Commission, Henry?
I think he gave them what information he had. There was some dispute about whether the bomb was meant for me or a friend of mine. And this friend, Indris is his name, we have a most bizarre argument. He says it's his bomb. I say, no, it's my bomb. that was the only area that I think was a bit uncertain.
Who it was meant for. And did he say why, what he understood, Henry, what he understood about why he was trying to kill you?
Well, if it was meant for the other guy was active in the underground, in the resistance. So that would have been self-evident. I really feel it was meant for me. Indris isn't around to claim it for him, so I've got the field to myself now. And I say that because Ruth First was killed. She wasn't a combatant. She was in Mozambique at the same time by a letter bomb. She was teaching at the university. Dulcie September was assassinated in Paris around about the same time as the bomb against me. I think they went for intellectuals. I've often said every intellectual taken seriously, maybe not quite that seriously. But partly this racist idea that they had that blacks are incapable of crafting a new constitution and fighting for freedom. They need whites behind them to be the agitators and the sort of masterminds. And also, Mozambique was right next to South Africa, and they wanted to clear the ANC out completely. I was a soft target. I was easier to get at. I suspect that was the reason.
Justice Albie Sachs is our guest. He is a justice of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, the Supreme Court, in our terms, was blown up by a car bomb in 1988, had been a member of the ANC, imprisoned during the apartheid regime. When you negotiated with the apartheid regime that had been the mastermind of the bombing. What was it like to sit down with those that had tried to kill you?
Well, as I was saying, the regime became the other side. So we negotiated with the other side. The first day was very, very strange. I remember putting on a suit, trying to look smart, and going into the World Trade Center, which was a very gloomy building, nothing like your brilliant twin towers around the corner from here, and on that soft carpeted floor, and feeling very, very uneasy, not because that was the enemy, because knowing that they could call up my whole past on, you know, that I was embodied in a tiny little microchip, and they could know everything about me, and we knew almost nothing about them. Not even that they had tried to kill me, that wasn't the issue. My great fear was that we would let something slip, that all the years of endeavor, all the sacrifices that had been made, if we lawyers somehow were too easily gulled and beguiled, too eager to get to elections, we might let everything go. And that was a terrible anxiety. I didn't sleep the first night. But you don't sleep the first night. Afterwards, you get on with the job in a professional way with lots of consultations, discussions, and so on. And we got a brilliant, brilliant constitution.
When you became the, when you were sworn in, the day you became a justice of the Supreme Court that you had helped to design, what was that day like?
It was a day of almost delirium of joy. I never dreamt of being a judge. It seemed impossible to me living in apartheid South Africa. I was glad when decent people became judges and did what tiny bit they could to preserve a bit of dignity for people, but it just seemed impossible for me. So I kind of ended up as a judge. But when people said, that's my reward, I got very upset. I got very upset because it wasn't a reward for long service, for being in there and fighting and so on. The reward was being in the fight. The reward was being part of the struggle. And the idea that we were in the struggle with the hope of one day getting some kind of reward other than living in democracy, that was terrible. And in fact, I've written about that in Soft Vengeance of Freedom Fighter. The vengeance that I wanted for what had happened to me was not to punish the individuals who'd been responsible for the bomb or to find myself in an elevated position, but to live in a democratic and open society. And I must say, I've been enjoying my Soft Vengeance for a number of years now, and it's lovely. I recommend it.
You've been listening to Albie Sachs, a constitutional court judge, justice in South Africa, and a leading member of the ANC. He's the author of numerous books, including The Jail Diary of Albie Sachs and The Soft Vengeance of a Freedom Fighter. That does it for today's show. For a copy of the show, please call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Gillian Aldrich and Sidrock Franklin. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Our engineer is Matthew Finch. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Thank you.